Hello, it's Jim Brown again with another Capercast of more lore. Modern nautical lore, that is. And I've been a bit undecided about how to go from here, and so I did the unexpected. I asked Christy what she thinks about it.
Well, Tiger, this is caper number 12, and you have not yet told us the difference between a catamaran and a trimaran. You're getting a bit of feedback from your listeners now, and that's what they are asking for. You've been pleading for feedback, and they like your quaint little sea stories, but they also want to hear some meaty stuff about the boats. So, you ninny?
Okay, Christy. But the differences between a catamaran and a trimaran are not simple, and that says nothing of the proa. And I'm going to start from the beginning, so it may take us two or three capers to get this in.
Go for it. But please just try to stay on point.
Okay, boss. Well, it sounds simple enough, but we could say that the catamaran has two hulls. They're twins. One is pretty much just like the other. The trimaran has three hulls, one big one in the middle with two training wheels, one on each side. And the proa is like a trimaran, but with only one training wheel on one side. We could leave it at that. Except that we better not forget the monohull. Let's face it, it's just one boat right there. That's all there is to it. So the big question becomes, why these differences? And to answer that question, we've got to go back at least 4,000 years, maybe more like 40 or 50,000 years. Because all of these watercraft configurations have evolved over eons and for a reason. They each have their explanations. I see them almost in a Darwinian sense. They have evolved, all right. If we choose to think of them in biological terms, they are all in the same phylum, okay, but they are distinctly different species of boat. And if we choose to really mix our metaphors here, we can also think of boats in their anthropological sense, besides their biological sense. The anthropology of boats is pretty interesting. And it's kind of a fast-breaking investigation because there has been a lot of recent evidence pop up to suggest that maybe early man and the sea goes back a lot earlier than most of us think. The anthropologists really like to trace the movements of humankind out of Africa and around the world. And apparently, according to the latest evidence and theories, the boat has played a much greater part in the movements of humankind around the planet than was previously thought. It now appears that the first people to really cross a big deal piece of open water were those folks from the island Asia area who somehow managed to move across to Australia and become today's Aboriginal people there. Now, nobody knows how they really got there and what sort of a vessel, but it is assumed that they did it in rafts and about 50,000, some say even 60,000 years ago. So there is another vessel type for us to consider now, the raft. It's logical to me that the first boats known to mankind were rafts. I mean, the first boat I ever built as a kid was a raft for poling around in a pond. It was the most basic floating technology around. And of course, a raft is just a collection of logs, but it's pretty darn difficult to make it move through the water. And so maybe, probably, the next technological step was to take one of those logs and sort of hollow it out, get a big one, and make it into a canoe. And indeed, the dugout canoe has a wonderful technology to it, which I guess we won't go into entirely here. But it turns out that in the end, a multi-hull is really a raft made of canoes. Now, a canoe by itself is really easy to push through the water. Its geometry is limited by the shape of the log, long and narrow. And I suppose you could take several canoes and gang them up side by side close together to make a raft, but that would be just about as hard to push through the water as a log raft. And of course, a canoe by itself is pretty tippy, relatively unstable. It didn't take the early humans long to figure out that they could take two canoes and join them together spaced wide apart and retain the advantages of narrow hull form while also achieving great stability. Now today we often look at it that way. Take two canoes and put them together to make a so-called catamaran. Well, there's another way to look at it. I think it's easier, structurally, to take one canoe and put it in the middle and fit it with outriggers on each side, the so-called training wheels. It's structurally easier than joining two big canoes together. It's also cheaper and easier. You don't have to have two big canoes. You can make your outriggers out of solid chunks of whatever, bamboo or whatever. So in my opinion, the trimaran or double outrigger canoe actually came first before the twin-hulled catamaran. And as a matter of fact, for reasons I'll explain, I think probably the proa also came before the catamaran. Now, maybe it doesn't make much difference which came first, but they all have their specific purposes. Now, I used to say that the multi-hull was probably the first true seafaring vessel known to mankind, aside from these rafts, if you want to call them seafaring. I don't consider them to be seafaring, even though people use them for crossing open water. They're so unmaneuverable. They're all capable of going primarily downwind and so on. A real seafaring vessel has to be able to sail at least across the wind and ideally against the wind. Now, these three multi-hull configurations, the double canoe, the single outrigger canoe, and the double outrigger canoe, all of them were given to us by the ancient people in what you can really call a canoe culture, an outrigger canoe culture. And as far as is known, that culture originated in Island Asia. And it probably happened sometime during the second millennium before Christ, or say 3,000 to 4,000 years before the present era. Now, it may have happened much earlier than that. Who knows? Perhaps the first Australians also used outrigger craft or monohull vessels. We just don't know. We don't have any evidence. But we do have evidence that the people of this canoe culture were making planned offshore voyages, sometimes of thousands of miles, out one year and back the next, knowing where they were going and knowing how to find their way back, sometime during that first millennium BC, or about 3,000 years ago. Now, the anthropologists have thought that these people of the Indo-Pacific and their outrigger canoe culture were making such voyages at about the same time that the first European people, first European seafaring people of the Mediterranean, so-called Phoenician people, were beginning to make their way out through what we now call the Straits of Gibraltar and feel their way down along the coast of Africa, always within sight of land. Of course, they were in the open sea, but they were not transocean navigators such as were the early Austronesian, Micronesian, Melanesian, and Polynesian people of the Indo-Pacific. Now, of course, the people of the outrigger canoe culture were, as far as is known, always sailing in vessels having more than one hull, multiple hull vessels, whereas the Phoenicians and other European seafarers were always sailing in vessels having one hull. Why is that? Incidentally, that's a question that in my tertiary studies I have not heard asked before. I have not heard answered before. I think I have an answer, at least for myself. And it's an answer that has come to me as a result of some fairly recent theory and evidence. And this evidence supports the theory that European seafarers were making transatlantic voyages much earlier, during the so-called Bronze Age, which may go back as far as 8,000 years, that Europeans were actually crossing the Atlantic. They were not on voyages of exploration. They were on voyages of trade and acquisition. And what they were acquiring was copper. Copper and tin, the main ingredients of bronze. These people were into metal, and the Pacific people were not. It appears that the purest copper ore on the face of the earth that was available during the so-called Bronze Age came from the Great Lakes region in what's now the United States and Canada. Apparently, ore of that purity is not found in quantities on the European continent. So it looks like European seafarers were bringing copper ingots from what we call the New World to the Old World many hundreds of years, maybe thousands of years, before Columbus so-called discovered America. And that would put them way before the people of the outrigger canoe cultures began to explore and populate the Indo-Pacific. Now, I can tell that Christy's ready to butt in here to keep on point. The thing, it does relate to the difference between catamarans and trimarans, because the people of the Atlantic, or the monohull culture people, required wide-hulled, burdensome vessels for carrying the weight of metal and metal ore and other heavy cargoes, particularly wine and olive oil stored in these giant amphora clay barrel-like containers. This was heavy stuff, and monohull vessels that make a big wide hole in the surface of the ocean are far better capable of carrying loads than are the narrow-hull vessels found in multi-hulls. And so, in my opinion, it's safe to assume that the real difference between the monohull mindset and the multi-hull mindset is one of load carrying. Monohulls can carry loads much better than multi-hulls. And that right there may explain the almost Darwinian difference between monohulls and multi-hulls. As Dick Newick used to say, if the multi-hull vessels of the early Pacific were capable of carrying cannons, we might not be speaking English today.
Come on, Jimmy. What does all that have to do with the difference between today's catamarans and today's trimarans? For Pete's sake, does the Bronze Age really matter here?
All right, Christy, maybe this is getting to the PhD level, you know, piled higher and deeper, but I think that in order to really understand the differences between these modern vessel types, one must apprehend what brought them into the world, what made them happen in the first place. Now, we really don't know a lot about those ancient canoe people and their vessels, the multi-hull outrigger canoe culture. There's very little forensic evidence, you know. We can't find the vessels themselves because they were all made out of 100% vegetable fiber. You know, shards of wood, pandanus matting, lashings made out of coconut coir. The whole thing was biodegradable. And incidentally, the anthropologists of the future may wish that our modern plastic production recreational vessels were also biodegradable. They're becoming quite a glut on the planet. Nobody knows how to get rid of them. And there's sure a lot of them around for sale cheap.
Jimmy Brownie, cut that out.
All right, that was wide of the mark, I admit, Christy. And I'm just as bad as anybody. I mean, you know, I designed those roto-molded polyethylene wind riders, and they've produced a couple 3,000 of them, and I fully expect some future paleontologist, you know, digging for bones is going to find one of those things buried in the sand. And you know, that stuff will never degrade if it's out of the sun, and he's going to wonder what the hell it was for. But again, I digress. And Christy's going to sound the alarm again, because I see I only have 4 minutes to wrap up this ancient multi-hull stuff, prerequisite to our understanding modern multi-hulls. So let me describe how I had a chance to work in the Philippines on a boat-building project there. I was at Cebu, which is the second largest city in the country, but some 500 miles south of Manila on a completely different island. And the people there spoke Visayan, one of the five different language groups, basic language groups in the Philippines. And with the help of my employer, who was a private client, I learned that the names of those five different language groups, those five different tribes of people, were the same as the names of the giant trimaran canoes that brought those people out from what is now Vietnam. Not very far. They didn't have far to go. And once they got into the Philippine archipelago, there were, you know, 8,000 islands, generally speaking, well-protected waters, balmy breezes, at least for most of the year. But these big trimarans, they call them Lumba Lumbas, were, I guess, up to like 150 feet long. And they carried the colonists out from the mainland of Asia to the Philippines. And the story goes that the reason they came out from the mainland was that they were literally driven out by having outstripped the mainland environment. They had started out as, you know, coastal fisher folk, but they were overwhelmed by a great migration coming down from China. And the Chinese were more technical. They really had their act together compared to the coastal folks, but the Chinese knew nothing of seafaring. These coastal people had been fishing along the coast in their double outrigger canoes, or what they called bancas. And that word banca descends from the earliest Austronesian word for boat, which is wanka, W-A-N-G-K-A, wanka. And of course, because these people were all members of the outrigger culture, wanka, or banka, or waka, or vaka, all those words imply a multi-hull boat. Now, apparently the same sort of migration occurred in other places along the Southwest Asian coast, where people moved out to the island groups. And of course, there they had virgin territory, and they flourished. And it didn't take long, who knows, maybe a couple of hundred generations or something. They had outstripped the islands, too. They were overpopulated. And now, to continue on eastward, out into the open Pacific, they were staring into the prevailing wind. Oh, there we go. I didn't make it, of course. We're going to have to go on with this the next time, when I hope to explain to you my own personal theory about how the ancient multi-hull developed from the double outrigger canoe, or trimaran, through the single outrigger canoe, or proa, and into the catamaran, or double-hulled canoe. Let's hope we can take it up next time seamlessly. With your patience, Thanks very much. I'll be back. Bye-bye.